program that Tim sketched out yesterday morning, this time we started, that our own project that he and I and others are working on the subject of what people do for a living, has got three beats on the string. And the first one is called tracking, namely trying to track, listen, and find out what a piece of daily lived experience is like from the very people who are there. Second piece is to get some biblical grounding in a word of God, a biblical text that might have promise for connecting with that. And then the third job, crossing those two. So today, we're going to try, at least at the outset, to sort of summarize section one, what we did yesterday, under those four, five, six words we've got there, and then push toward some probing in a biblical text, the one that Carol Hinderly preached on, the Sunday epistle, Romans 6. I know not many folks have Bible, but we'll read it. It's familiar to you, and we can at least talk about that. And then if we get something out of those biblical diggings on tomorrow, we'll at least try to do some bridge building between this column and that column, your daily work and the way you experience it and some of the words that seem to make sense when you label them as part of your experience, the Word of God, and the crisscross on Thursday between the two of us. What I've got here are three sets of paired terms that reflect things that I thought I heard in stronger or shorter measure. And I'm just going to comment on them briefly, just what the words mean in my head, because I put them out there. And Tim's then going to show you where he heard different comments, which he wrote down, that seemed to hook in to those, at least a number of those. You said yesterday, and I say about myself, that in my daily lived experience, I experience myself both as fated and as free. And initially those sound like contradictions, at least partly contradictory. Some of the things are just given to me over which I have no control. You know, it's just my fate. I didn't ask, for example, to be born in the 20th century. You know, no one gave me my choice. You know, you want to be born in the 19th century, 21st century. I didn't ask to be born Caucasian. I didn't ask to be born male. I didn't ask to be born of German parents. You know, a whole raft of things about my being are fated, are given to me over which I have no control. Other things I have a modest amount of control, but they become fate for me. The woman I married, I could have theoretically married somebody else, but once that occurred, that became a fateful piece. That was a given for me. We had some control over how many kids we were going to have, but once we had the ones we got, that becomes a piece of the given fate in which I live. By accident, really, at least I didn't plan it that way. I was in St. Louis on the faculty of Concordia Seminary 801 Des Moines on January 20th, 1974. And because of that, I'm now in seminary. I didn't plan it that way. That's a thing that was given to me over which I had very little actual control. However, there are lots of places where we have a good deal of control. And some of you were talking that way. I remember Barbara from La Jolla said, you know, she thought folks who come out of college have a lot more freedom in terms of options that they could choose. And other folks challenged even that, whether that was true now, although it might have been true 20 years ago, whatnot. Okay, so fate and freedom, I heard stuff like that coming. Values and evaluation. Perhaps because this is a Christian group, a number of you very naturally made connections between your work and value and worth, and even Christian value and worth, and doing God's will or God's work, or paying attention to religious things of importance. So that the fact that we have values is present in our lived experience about our daily work. And that in the daily work, we ourselves get evaluated, is what the word evaluation wants to suggest. People critique us. Not just the bosses above us who evaluate us, but the supposed underlings under us are regularly engaged also in evaluating us. And that doesn't just happen at work. That happens all over the place in daily life. Parents and kids in both directions, husbands and wives in both directions, colleagues on a faculty and students, folks that work together in the kitchen, when you just say, hey, you shouldn't have done that. You know, you dumped hot water on something. That's already evaluating a person for something that he did and making an evaluation about him. Values and evaluation. And the last one, the lived experience of some kind of threat or some kind of unpleasantness or some kind of ouch Toward the end of the hour, we focused it on, you know, the villain. And I put that in quotes at the moment now, you know, who is the villain, the tyrant, or the oppressor, or the suppressor, or whatever. At least a number of you, as I recall, made statements that in your living, what you do for a living, you also have occasional or even frequent experiences of this. Maybe the threat is just the limit, you know, I can't do what I want to do. I'd like to really do this and this, you know, he'd like to really learn how to fly an airplane and get his pilot's license. But at the moment, somebody or something or circumstances don't let that happen yet. If you got that $100,000 bonanza, then that's one of the things. Terry, is that your name?
Right.
Terry said he would do. Okay, in general, that's at least a general picture of what those words suggest in my head. They came out of my head for today. Now, Tim's going to be a little more explicit. That just gives you a few more almost direct quotes of some of the things you heard you say to tag on to that. And then we can open it up for give and take. But after 15 or 20 minutes of that, I'd like to push on, you know, to part two of our program and just see what we come up with.
You'll get a chance to respond to this. Just to go through those points again, some things that I perceived both yesterday morning and yesterday in the session we had, the book reading session. Now, if you weren't there, it doesn't make any difference because I can explain it then. The first category of fate and freedom. I heard yesterday a lot of emphasis on the word choice and decision. In fact, you can almost make a synonymous equation with choice equals the fulfillment. The feeling of fulfillment in a job. If you have the freedom of choice and decision, you feel fulfilled in a job. And in fact, the essence of personhood. You know, when a person really feels a person is when he is making choices. We are called to make choices. You know, it is something that we feel that we're called to do, and we reflect that in our needs. We want to be free to choose. That came out yesterday in many kinds of instances where people were talking about work and how they wanted to choose what they wanted to do. But yet, at the same time that we are called to choose and that we need to choose in order to feel person, at the same time we experience what we call fate. That is sort of a determinism which almost blunts our freedom of choice. Many people were talking in some ways about tyranny from the top. You know, that there is perhaps bureaucratic pressure or principalities and powers which take away our freedom of choice. They make us non-person. We aren't free to choose what we want to do, how we want to do something. And then very interesting little excerpt from an interview we read yesterday in the afternoon session from a copy chief, John Fortune. He gives a very good analysis of fate, at least in his own life. John Fortune is a very creative person. That's his job, to create things in advertising. He loves to make choices. He loves the burden of decision. In fact, he went into a job which required greater work, but the luxury of that work was that he was free to choose. But then John Fortune, in one little paragraph, reflects the kind of fate that choice has to meet. And he says, advertising is a fashion business. There are five stages. Who is this guy, John Fortune? The second stage. Gee, it would be great if we could get that guy, what's his name, John Fortune. The third stage. If we could only get John Fortune. The fourth stage. I'd like to get a young John Fortune. The fifth stage. Who's John Fortune? There are no old writers. And so the kind of fate that oppresses us is the fate of a system that wants certain types of people. A system that is primarily death-oriented. You know, things come and go, and we like young things, we don't like old things. So the contrast between freedom and fate. It's a very live one, I think, in the way we talk about our jobs. The second category, values and evaluation. There's a prevalent feeling among some people, I've heard it in both talk of the Old Testament prophets here in a discussion group and in a talk of Paul Tournier last week, that who a person is separated from what a person does. Or to say it in a religious language, God loves the sinner but hates the sin. I don't think the biblical record would support such a statement, in that what we do is exactly how we are evaluated as a person. And what we do on the job daily, and what we think about our job, how we act in our job, is not an evaluation of our acts only, but it finally comes back to be an evaluation of us. We are daily evaluated in our work. When somebody criticizes, for instance, on the job, your work, your potential, your output, or whatever, your attitude, you can't go away from that job feeling like, well, they were just criticizing what I did or how I felt. They were criticizing me. You know, daily we come under the tyranny of evaluation. One of the things that Studs Terkel's book on working points out in the introduction, and through the interviews this is very prevalent, and Studs makes a point of it. He says one of the things that came out over and over again was how in America, how people really feel watched. You know, watching and evaluation is a big part of working. And how we're always asked the question, how am I doing? How am I doing? And who are my evaluators? That whole dynamic. Just as another little input, we read a book, The Holy Masquerade, last week. And it's a wife's diary of her feelings and her attempt to deal with her husband, Albert, who's a Swedish pastor. At the end of the book, Albert gives his reaction to his wife's sort of very oppressive analysis of him, very aggressive and sharp and critical. And Albert gives sort of his evaluation of his wife's evaluation of him. And he says, one thing about my wife is I always felt I was being watched and not loved. That's where you can feel with Albert. That's about the only place where you can feel with Albert, because you feel like Albert really is as his wife says he is. But the oppression of watching. How am I doing? Okay, that's category two. Number three, threat and the villain, or as one poem calls it, the hound of heaven. There's been a lot of talk about pressure. I think I pointed out yesterday how someone's experienced the pressure from the top, and we tried to point out where the pressure ends. You know, what bureaucratic office does the buck finally stop? Harry Truman said. No, it doesn't stop at my office. It keeps on growing. You know, there's sort of we live in a system of pressure. Sometimes we don't even know who's pressuring us. We just know we're pressured to do something, to be something.
Let me interrupt you. How many of you people in your daily work have enough time to do what you're expected to do? Just put your hand up. How many people think, on average, I really have enough time to do what I'm expected to do? You notice there's only about five hands up. Have you got enough time to do your retirement?
You have enough time to do your work. That's good.
I'd like to point out, though, a lot of times, when I was working, I had to pressure myself because I took on jobs which some people should have been doing, to get myself so sort of lax with pressure than what I'm doing. Sometimes, it's more work, but this is necessary pressure. Some people get pressured, other people can relax and look. Sometimes it's more time, but you still do it without pressure. You know, this way it's longer, you can find that pressure.
Okay, that's, I think another way of saying this third category, if you put threat and the villain, you could put behind those two words guilt. It is impossible to escape from guilt in the kind of work we do. And not just the kind of guilt that we can easily put away and say, oh, that's part of human living. You know, guilt is something that a part of work, and it's not an easy part of work. In fact, even between the choices that we want to make, you know, the first category was choice. To feel personhood, we want to make choices and decisions. Well, one of the consequences of grabbing the freedom of choosing is that you've got to take the responsibility for your choices. Mm-hmm. And part of the responsibility of choosing involves a tremendous, well, that word's a sensitive word, tremendous amount of guilt. You know, even between two goods, much of guilt comes not between choosing between right and wrong, but between the two goods. To make a choice involves a negation of something else. And that negation incurs feelings of guilt. I wish I could do it. I wish I had more time to do it. I wish I could choose both. You know, on and on, there are many situations in our work where no matter what we do, no matter how good the choices are, it involves guilt. And so part of human existence, a great part, is coming under the feeling of threat and guilt. How do we handle that? The need for choice and decision making, yet the experience of guilt and threat. I remember last year when we had some doctors, well, it was 2 years ago, we had a course at Seminex where we had some doctors in, who were talking about all the new things that were happening in the medical world. In fact, we have a little group in St. Louis called Institute for Theological Encounter with Science and Theology, ITEST, where we bring in physicists and biologists and all sorts of scientists and theologians. And it's interesting that in this high power packed group where there are people there that are constantly in high decision making positions, how the question keeps coming up, you know, how can I choose what to do? And the kind of underlying threat that no matter what choice I make, someone or something's going to be hurt. You know, I feel threatened by my the ramifications of my choices. So, the three categories. You can now, you know, we have time to talk about that. There could be some corrections or additions, or maybe someone disagrees terribly with what we said.
I'll just add one more word, and that's the word God. Tim has been secular yet and not mentioned the Creator. One could, and I think biblical scriptures do, when they're talking about, let's call it initially, the old creation. Still God's creation, but it's the fractured one. The one we get born into the first time by our first birth. In that old creation, God is the one who has given me my 20th century Caucasian German masculinity. You know, at least if that's what I mean when I recite Luther's little catechism, I believe that God has made me and all creatures and given me all these things. And then God at least is the subject of the sentence about, you know, well, how did you get fated with all these givens? God is also the one who calls me to make decisions. Insofar as I've got the freedom to be at crossroads and say, I could go this way, I could go that way. God is the evaluator as well as the one who specifies what values are valuable. And if I, as a fractured Adam, like the original Adam, get called to account by God, and he says, Edvak wo bist du, instead of Adam wo bist du, Ed, where are you? That evaluation, and if it's a threatening one, has God himself as the judge, as the evaluator, as the checker outer. You don't have to envision him as being, you know, nasty and harsh and angry. He can be just kind of a cool, you know, cool judge to say, how you doing? I expected this and this and this. You know, what's the record look like? And the pressure to be someone, to be good, to be a good work person, to do well on the job, is not just, you know, egomania or whatnot, but God himself pressures us to be good fathers, good mothers, wives, husbands, children, teachers, lawyers, ditch diggers, staff at Holden Village. So, even though we haven't mentioned the word God explicitly, I want it to be understood that these words specify aspects of, if you will, of our experience of God in daily work, in a very concrete and, you know, lived, felt, experienced thing.
I'm really changing into the guilt thing as far as decisions go. At least for myself, I know that a lot of times people like to play at that and want you to feel guilty, especially the church people, you know, if you don't want to teach Sunday school this year, maybe you want to do another study, or maybe you want to do something else. But I don't feel guilty when I have to make a decision because I don't feel like I'm negating something.
Has it ever happened,
though? It's a system of priorities, though.
Has it ever happened in your life as you reflect on it? No. Mm-hmm. Suppose Tim just sort of, stimulated you, to say the least, with that idea. Would you reflect on it now? Can you ever think of a moment when, sure enough, I made a choice, both of the options were good. You know, if I'd gone that way, that would have been a good thing to do for myself and for other people. If I went that way, that would have been a good thing to do myself and other people. But because I went this way, I in effect had to say no to that one, and that meant saying no to people.
I guess, you know, I feel guilt for different reasons, I guess. Not decisions to do things. Don't, you know, in dealing with people sometimes directly. I mean, you're making it sound like you're choosing between two activities, two jobs, two, you know what I mean?
I think, I hear Tim say... Yeah, the gal sitting next to you who just talked. Here, I'll make Jan present a glorious example. No, Walter Booman, her husband, chose for this week to fulfill an obligation, you know, to be delegate at the Missouri Synod Convention.
Mm-hmm.
By doing that, he has just, you know, as a matter of fact, deserted, I'll use that harsh word, the obligation of being practicing husband and practicing father to the kids that he left here.
He just has a different idea of his obligation here.
But if you would ask that wife, I bet if you would ask that wife and those three kids, you know, is that a deficit that husband and daddy are gone all week? I bet they'd say yes.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, his action has, in effect, you know, had negative consequences for those people. Now, my point is not, can't you find a way that you could save it? Tim's point is, in the world after Eden, that's the normal thing. That's not the abnormal thing. That choices between two goods involve you saying no to another good. If you can only pick one.
You're saying that's bad and that you should feel guilty about
it. I didn't say you should feel guilty. I said you are guilty.
Let me give an example real quick. One that I felt very intensely. A student will come up to me who's done bad work in the course,
mm-hmm,
and ask for a passing grade. And I will know this student. He will appeal to me. He will point out to me that if he gets the passing grade, he'll graduate. If he graduates, a job is waiting, mm-hmm, for him. You know, and in terms of the human consequences of that, if I am at all charitably disposed, even though he deserves an F, I will give him a D or a C. And yet I can't do that. I'm the defender of some standards. So if I did this, that's one that I feel badly no matter what I choose. Yeah, I have to choose.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Okay, well, Tim didn't mean this to be the big point on this. We'd like to say, in your daily work, does any of this ring true to you personally? We were suggesting, from what we heard yesterday, we thought it did, but, you know, that might just tell you more about our ears than it does about your lives.
I would take one term he used, that is, when a circumstance, you become another person. I think that term should be thrown out because no matter what happens, you are a person. You're only something else.
Well, we cannot be non. How do you say that?
It's too many negatives.
It's impossible to be a non-person.
Yeah, right.
Therefore, we have to choose. Therefore, we incur guilt. So it's impossible not to be guilty. Well, that's a little botch.
No. Forget about the word guilt, Tim.
Yeah, right.
Just stick with the words that are off the board. How about threat? Do you experience threat on the job, even if you don't have a personified villain to tie it up to? You know.
I just like to say that in my job, if I weren't a Christian, I think by now I would have either had a nervous breakdown or something. I feel very guilty and frustrated in my work as a registered nurse because of not having enough time to accomplish what I hope to accomplish in my 8-hour day. But this business of guilt, you know, like when you're in a room with, say 11 babies and three stop breathing periodically and one's on a respirator and all of a sudden the respirator quits working and you've got two babies over there that aren't breathing, like, and you're one person there, what are you going to do? You know, you just have to run. And so the little one on the respirator maybe dies because you couldn't run fast enough.
Okay. If you're you say your Christian resources makes it possible for you to survive under those, you know,
yeah,
frightfully twisting and contortion situation. Could you just, you know, give us a sentence or two on how so?
Well, I've only had these situations happen maybe four times, you know, in the roughly 3 years I've worked in a premature nursery, but it's like being thrown into an impossible situation.
Who throws you into that impossible situation?
Well, I've thrown myself into it because I've accepted a job.
Oh, who gave you those six babies at one time to take care of, all of whom are dying, and you can only take care of one, maybe two?
Yeah.
Who gives you more work than you got time to do?
The director of nursing will only hire so many women for our department. So it's,
she's the real villain? What would it take for you to say, God is the one who gave me this impossible situation? And if there's anyone who I'm really mad at, it's him.
I don't blame God.
I didn't ask you, would you blame God? I said, why do you refrain apparently from putting God in that sequence and saying, if there's someone in charge of the universe, he must have put me in this impossible situation before I yet blame or unblame him, to say, my gosh, he must be the villain at the end of the line, or the...
Yeah, I never felt that way. I've done a whole lot of, pardon the expression, bitching about not having any more help, and I've had some real good fights with certain people. And, you know, it's just, that's the way the system is. And you know...
Who set up the system? And I'm going to keep needling you at the moment, at least, to say...
Well, the hospital sets up the system. You are allowed so many grads for your area. The director of nursing sets up the system, eh?
Why does God let her do that? Do it that way?
Because the government, she's got the government.
Why does God give us such terrible government? I'm pulling your leg. Am I going to stop? Why does God let us be so dumb to elect such a dumb government?
Well,
yeah, I want you to be arguing with God rather than just with your supervisor. At least I'd like you to, you know, to reflect on that. Because in the Old Testament, you know, when we've got a serious Old Testament or New Testament hero of the faith who's really being put through the grinder, he doesn't find it just saying, gee, I'm going to argue with Pontius Pilate or that blankety blank Sanhedrin, that's the guy who did it. But, you know, our Lord and Master himself, when he's finally nailed, he says, mine God, why are you forsaking me? And that's just a sample of the way many an Old Testament man, when he finally argues with the villain at the end of the line, he's arguing with God.
But it's the humanness, you know, of all these people that have made them the sin.
Didn't the Creator make them? How did they get that way if God wasn't in the mix someplace? Well, maybe I should back off. One of the reasons I frequently heard, occasionally I think, when folks are hesitant to make that last horrendous leap that I'm pushing you toward right now.
Yeah.
And I'm not making it because I say, ha-ha, that's the thing to make, do that and then everything's okay. No, that is a horrendous, horrible ditch
to
jump.
I can take it,
come on. Most often when I have heard serious Christian people like you serious about this, the reason, or one of the reasons why they can't make that kind of statement on the, you know, the negative diagnostic side, that things are really at root that bad. It's worse than having, you know, just damnable government and damnable healthcare system. But the Creator himself is somehow culpable in this mess. The reason they can't do that is they don't have a big enough salvation on the other side of the ledger to be able to handle something that bad.
Well, you see, I believe so strongly. I had an awful problem with one girl that I worked with. She was a real problem to me. She would sit on her butt and do, you know, and I couldn't move her no matter how. And I just couldn't take it. and she would work in main nursery and I'd be in stuck in premature nursery, and if I had a baby come flying in, she'd, you know, she'd just be oblivious. And the idea is you're supposed to come right away and help this other girl. And I would, you know, I'd ream her out and she's blank. So I started to pray about it. I said, God, you know what she's like, and, you know, she's not helping me any, and she's not helping anybody around here, so do something about it. And he did something about it.
What?
She got fired. Because I could go to the head nurse and say, like, look, at, you know, this is happening. I was in charge of evenings, and this girl was useless to me. And, I mean, I could say to her, you know, like, please, will you talk to Lee? I've talked to her. I've reasoned with her. I've said, you know, and she's not doing anything. Would you please talk to her? And,
yeah, no,
you
know,
I prayed about it, and I went away on vacation. And when I came back, she was no longer there. And I thought, God, you answered my prayer.
Maybe a bit of secular input from a young man that we read yesterday in the afternoon, John Fortune, who, from the interview, doesn't give any indication that he's a Christian. He's not thinking theologically. But he said something in a postscript to Stud Circle, who's interviewing him, which is very revealing about the sort of the question mark behind the daily evaluation of us. Now, there's something bugging us. Where and what that is, we really don't know, but there's something bugging us. This thing that we call villain or critic. Mm-hmm. And he says, Stud says, at a pub in mid-Manhattan frequented by advertising people, he said, John Fortune said, quote, I have a reoccurring dream in which I'm a stand-up comedian. I'm standing on a stage with a blue spotlight on me, talking. I begin by telling jokes. Gradually, I begin to justify my life. I can't quite see the audience. I don't know who's there. The light becomes more and more intense. I can't remember what I say. I usually end up crying. This dream I have had maybe 3 or 4 times.
Some of you who are in literature and know it much better than I are aware that these 4 lines from John Fortune here are a prominent theme in some of the existentialist literature. Albert Camus, The Fall, and other things where people perceive that they're somehow, you know, before the bench, or they're being evaluated, or they're on trial. Or Kafka's book, The Trial, which is precisely that. There's this Joseph K. goes through the whole book, and he knows he's on trial, he's under charge for somebody, he can never quite figure out just what it is that he's on trial for, who's the judge, who's the critic, or who's the plaintiff, or the defendant, or he's the defendant. The play that Arthur Miller wrote in relation to Marilyn Monroe, I guess, after The Fall. The chief person in there is Clinton, a trial lawyer, and at one point Clinton says, it suddenly occurred to me that my whole life I have been living as though I were arguing my case before the bench. And one day I looked up and I saw there was nobody in the chair up there. You know, that's an atheist way of saying, my lived experience was that I had to defend myself, although I never did see, and I don't believe there is any final critic anywhere, but at least the experience of being evaluated as though there were a final critic who is saying, man, woman, you're on trial, and you got to either be justified or you're going to be condemned, or something threatening at least. I'd like to get, since we focused in on this, and I pushed it, I know, but you gave us this glorious material for doing that, at least gave me. How would some of the rest of you respond? Is there any way that last sentence that I wrote up there can make sense to you? Or is it just too far out, or just plain false, or whatever? You know, at the moment, just because it's on the blackboard doesn't mean it's true. It says, I erased the business about threat and the villain. I just formulated this the way our conversation has gone here now. God himself, as the final critic, as the threatener, in the structures of my job, you know, without denying that there's, you know, supervisors and all sorts of normal, you know, regular human structures, but that God himself is somehow
somehow, question mark, in that operation, and he's the guy at the end of the line pushing somehow the criticism. When you get criticism on your job, would that sentence help you make any sense of that experience? Or does it just, you know, cluster things?
I have been into the book, The Problem of Pain, which suggests in there is the Old Testament that God is thought of as the source of good as well as evil. In other words, pain comes to him too. And in the New Testament, however, there would seem to be a strong emphasis that God is the giver of every perfect gift. The good comes from God, but the evil and the pain comes from some other source, maybe the devil or forever. How do you feel about that? Do you feel that we are either looking at God as the source of good and evil or pain? Or is the devil really the demonic, really big problem in this?
If you take the, what I think is C.S. Lewis's option, you read C.S. Lewis, The Problem of Pain?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I think it's, you get very close to finally having, you know, two deities, one a good God and the other one a bad God. And they're both more or less equal, although, you know, in the long run, you know, good God is going to finally lick bad God. But there's no direct linkage or direct control that devil has or the power of evil. I think the biblical record wants us not to think that way. Wherever the tempter or the evil one appears in the scriptures, he is a creature. In some form, he's a creature. You know, he's not separate, equal, and on his own alongside the Creator. So he's under God. You know, the serpent is you know, an animal in the Garden of Eden, in the Genesis temptation story. And elsewhere, wherever the devil is personified in the scriptures, in the story of Job, the opening chapter, the devil, or the prosecuting attorney, actually, the Hebrew word is sick for Satan, is prosecuting attorney. Shatan, and it says, though God's holding court up in heaven, and one of the sons of God, one of his underlings, is HaShatan, and he says, hey, what have you noticed? And he said, hey, I've been doing Job's turf, and you know what I found? That guy's guilty. That guy worships you, but he only worships you because of all the goodies you shower on. He doesn't trust you for yourself, he trusts you for, you know, pay. And so then the Job story unfolds, because the prosecuting attorney has put the finger on Job's guilt, although at the moment it's covered up. Even God didn't know it. Okay, so the devil is always a creature, not in any sense co-equal with the Creator. In Deuteronomy, I think, there's a quote, I kill and I make alive, says Yahweh. Nobody gets out of my hand. I think that the Deuteronomist tradition in the early or late 7th century is formulating that precisely in the face of this alternative to say, wouldn't it make better sense? Couldn't we make better sense of our experience to say, you know, there's a power of life and goodness, and the plus things in life, that's Yahweh. And then there's the power of death and darkness and evil, and the Canaanite god system of the Ugarites and whatnot. They had names for different ones. The big one was Mut. His name meant death. Would it make better sense to have two gods, to have a dietheistic system? But the biblical writer says, you can't put a false, it ain't true. And you can't be a consistent Hebrew if you say that, because Yahweh alone is creator, and if there's anything else in the cosmos, it's in some sense under him, not equal to him. So the Luther, when he uncorked his corny little phrase, we must remember that the devil is, after all, God's devil, is at least in that same tradition, to not let old Nick be, you know, separate and equal. And therefore, that makes the problem tougher, though. So how can God be, if we just stick with this phrase, how can God himself be the final critic and still be the source of life? For me, the very guy who's getting critiqued here. And for that, I think, ultimately, or these Christians say, my gosh, that's what the Holy Testament's all about. How much time do you got? I'll tell you the story of Jesus. But if you don't have the way you would get started. I gave you a lecture, and you just asked a question. Did I buy...
I may be, you know, punted off in the left field from what you want to do.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I was in effect throwing at you. I mean, maybe that would be a way to go at this. How big a self-savior does it really take, would it take, if this is really the depth of the problem, not just that other human beings, sinners, give us a lot of trouble, or not just that the structures of society are so twisted up that they give us trouble, or not even just that the devil, who's a supernatural, or somehow the power of evil is loose in the world that gives us trouble. But suppose Yahweh himself is the one who gives us sinners trouble. I mean, you know, isn't that the way the Genesis story of creation goes when it's all over? You know, by Genesis chapter 3, God doesn't say, okay, serpent, I'm going to kick you out of the garden. You're the lost food, you did it all, and if I get rid of you, then we got the problem solved. The serpent somehow slithers away, and you never find out what happened to him. The people take the wrath, and Yahweh gives them the wrath. So at that point, he is their problem. Not even their own sinfulness is their problem. You know, they in effect could say, well, we could live with our own sinfulness if that God didn't come walking around the garden checking on us. But he's their problem.
You know, I think that, you know, when we were talking before, I think I was lying when I said that I don't blame God or play God sometimes, because I've had babies die that I really mourn for. I think I mourn for everyone, but some more than others, because I've lived with them longer. And I remember one in particular that I really mourned for. And I went through a period of, why God? Why? And I remember one instance where I just give this example, and I still am troubled with this. Somebody did the feed with a tube baby, put a tube down and feed it. And I was feeding this baby, and we had a baby in a little cradle type of thing next to this child. And it had been born, and the mother had been on, I don't know what kind of drugs, and it was an extremely deformed child, double sex lips, and it was really the worst deformed child I ever seen. In fact, there were some dads that couldn't look after that child, that bothered me. And I could look after that child. And I pray that, that if, this child, I can see how it could live, this way. And I was feeding this baby, and I heard this baby kind of make noise, and it just sounded like it was maybe just making noise. So I finished what I was doing, and I quickly went and checked, and this baby was dead. So I quickly, in my mind, the quick decision was, do you resuscitate or do you retrieve it?
Mm-hmm.
I listened to the heartbeat. There was still a heartbeat there. So morally, I felt I had to do something. So I suctioned the baby out. I had just been seen, and it must have choked somehow, I suctioned the baby out, and then I pressed the buzzer quickly that called the other grad. And when we tried to resuscitate this child, the baby died. At that point, I thank God. I went through a turmoil of feeling guilty that I didn't go to that child quicker when it made the sound. But at the same time, I thought, God, you made a decision, or something. I just went, and yet to this day, I have this feeling, that I should have gone sooner. But I fought God, I really had that struggle there. So I guess I didn't know why, but I just had never really thought of fighting God, but I guess I really have in my work.
Carol, I've heard something. I may have heard it wrong.
Probably not.
Now I have but it seems to me that you're saying that in a choice situation, there's a good choice and a bad choice. The good choice related to what God allows you or wants to do. The other choice, the bad choice, is the creature choice, and that's what you said earlier. And that becomes too much of a burden, I think, for a human being to handle.
Why do you think that's too much of a burden? I mean, you're right in the first thing. We're not talking about choosing between something that clearly looks bad and clearly looks good. We're saying you got two things, both of those should look good. We use Walt Bowman as an example. It's good for him to fulfill his vocation to be delegate to the convention. It's also good for him to be here with his family on vacation and be responsible to you people. He's supposed to be a teacher for you folks. Well, and if he opts for one, he's got to say no to the other.
All right. Now, what I've heard is that saying no may be defined by some person as being siding in with the creature. And anytime you get that sort of an interplay between something, you can become very good mental.
I don't know what you mean by, quote, siding in with the creature. That term,
you're talking about Satan being the creature. You know, the bad decision.
My response to him was just that biblical theology doesn't allow Satan to be anything more than a creature. And to side in with creatures per se is not bad. You know, well, I side in with you, you're a creature, I'm a creature. If we're friends and we're siding in with creatures.
Yeah, I heard your term creature in this. Yeah. I heard it's evil. And the one choice is an evil choice, the way I've heard you say it. Now,
well, we didn't want to be saying that. I wanted to be taking off on what Tim said when we started. That to make decisions inevitably involves in guilt, not just when you have to decide to do something good and something bad, but when you have to decide between two things that are good. You somehow hurt somebody else. Now you might say, well, the people understand that. I can't be two places at one time. And maybe they should. But as a matter of fact, they get hurt. And they got hurt because I decided to go to Anaheim instead of to stay here. If I'd stayed here, they wouldn't have gotten hurt. Folks at Anaheim might have.
When that's too big of a burden, that means no matter what you're doing, you're always doing wrong.
I want to say something. You ever read this book? Ever read this book?
I want to say it does matter,
but my point would be it matters on how you respond or how you live with that situation. And I heard you say, what's your name?
Susan.
I heard Susan say the way I live with it is I just refuse to accept the guilt for that. I just say no, that ain't so.
Because every time you turn around, there's something wrong. Either you did something wrong, somebody makes you think you did something wrong, and it doesn't matter. And we're talking about a state of grace. And
no, we're not yet.
Well, okay, but that's the whole point of this thing. In my mind, anyway.
Okay, but you, I heard you.
Okay. And then where you go from there. You know,
you're
not going to carry it around.
You're
not going to carry guilt around.
Up until you said state of grace in your third last second, I heard you using other resources for getting rid of the problem that we had described. I did not hear you using Jesus Christ. I did not hear you using him. And the point is not that I didn't hear him. I heard you using something else to get rid of the alleged guilt. You used common sense, or you used your own simple rationality, or you just ruled it out of court. You said, same story.
It's so futile to...
It's only futile if you can convince yourself that number three is a mistake, is erroneous. Because if he still is the critic, then for me to say, oh, that's, you know, it's futile, it's irrelevant, forget about it. But if he says, the hell you're going to forget about it, I ain't going to forget about it, at least not yet, then you got to come to terms with it. Mm-hmm. And you got to do it more than just facilely to say, you know, well, obviously I can't, therefore...
So
I
then you come to the point, can't you say, well, I made this choice because this is what I felt he wanted me to do, so I'm stumbling in his plan.
Yeah.
He's the one that caused me to make the choice.
He's been waiting to come.
Yeah.
Well,
he's permanent staff. I only get one chance here.
Well, I don't want to argue. What I want to say, I can support you, Ed.
I'm
going to talk in a first-person singer. I suspect that everybody else will do it too. If I receive criticism from a source, that some person whom I know is wicked, and everybody knows it. I know there are people like we just know we've never met this person But we know that he's really bad. He's corrupt. He's not, you remember the mafia thing. And finally, he criticized me. I don't worry about that criticism because I know that criticism is not grounded in the good. It comes from the evil. And ultimately, I'm saying that criticism does not have the mind of God. Now, suppose I get criticism from a fellow worker who's not, who's clearly not unambiguously bad. I find myself immediately trying to justify myself. And I mean coming up with an explanation of why that person's criticism is not grounded in the good. You know, see, he's only criticizing me because, in fact, he's a sloppy worker and he's jealous. That's one way of doing it. And suppose, or I may go to a higher authority. I say, well, but I know my colleague doesn't. He criticizes me. The dean really approves. And then suppose I find out that the dean doesn't approve. Then I evaluate the dean. And what I'm always looking for, and I think everyone does this, that theist or atheist, you finally look for that which is ultimately good. And when you find that your action is consonant with the good or the will of God, then you feel justified. And I go through that process. I go through it constantly. And I justify myself in this way by going far enough. But then I also have these moments, you know, something collapses in my elaborate, because sometimes the structure has to be very elaborate. I forget how I justify this action. And something collapses on me, and then I really wonder whether I have successfully justified myself, or I get caught up in the realization that in the process of justifying myself, I slip some links in the argument. I go to the ignore some things, I've got to justify myself ultimately before God, which includes everything. I can't leave anything out of account then. But when I really try to take everything into account or even get close to that, I find I am not justified. I this criticism was that. So I find myself in this double mind, trying to justify myself, going to God, and usually working with successfully, but the structure collapses too often for me to be convinced that it's going.
That would be a glorious point to move from to get to that participle of their grounding. What is the grounding? In what is our justifying of ourselves grounded? You know, individual instances or, you know, the whole smear. And Paul has just given us an example of how in different ways he seeks to ground his own justification, his own righteousness. You know, if some SOB criticizes him, then Paul grounds that I'm okay and that guy isn't because he's an SOB and he's not concerned about the good anyhow, and therefore the grounding of Paul's justification, of Paul being okay at that point, is just the baselessness of that other guy's, you know, whole way of operation. But then these other alternatives, which are more complex, are additional ways to ground, to find a foundation that'll hold for the fact that, you know, by golly, I'm okay even when I get critiqued. What makes this, the way we've got it sketched out here, so frightful, I guess, is that we've got the source of being on the critic side. You know, the source of our existence is not simply over on that side. He's going to justify us, and we've got, you know, these SOBs over here, the structures of society, or a dumb dean, or even a good dean. But we've got God himself on the critic side. And therefore, obviously, God himself, at least, is going to have to be on that side to ground a justification of me that will manage, that will handle, that will conquer, that will trump, that will take care of the criticism. It seems to me that the reason I suggested Romans 6 was not just because it was the text that Carol preached on 3 days ago, but in that very section of Romans, maybe even the whole book of Romans, but in Romans 6 and Romans 5, I hear Paul almost explicitly say, Paul saying, by golly, that's my agenda for these two chapters. What are the grounds on which I claim to be justified, on which I claim to be right? And he makes no hanky-panky about it, that he's concerned about being right in the face of the big critic, not just in the face of what my fellow Jews say about me now that I've ratted out and become a Christian, or what those Christians say about me because I used to be a guy who persecuted the Christians, or whatever. In the face of the big critic, what are the grounds for my saying, I'm really okay?
and that okayness stands, and it's big enough, you know, to trump the big criticism. But we're at the end of our hour.
No, 12 minutes.
We've got 12 minutes.
One thing about
Have you asked him about sound? Do you want to start this at 10 minutes to 12, or do you want to do bell, or do you want
to... Should we just close off and pick it up here tomorrow? What do you think? I mean, you all can go back at the moment. All I get to do is read Romans 5.
Well, we didn't need to pick the book home. Well, a very interesting thing that you brought up, that's one means, and maybe all of us can do this. I think Ed used to criticize me for being too legalistic, and in the papers I wrote when we were in classes together. But I think it's important that before we move on to the good word that gets us out of the inextricable mess, to ask ourselves, how do we actually, concretely justify ourselves in the daily work we do? How did I justify myself this morning when I forgot to make lunches for a group that was going to Dalphy at 8 o'clock in the morning? That incurred, you know, a lot of guilt, bad news. How did I get myself out of this? Well, that's another story. Yeah, that's what I want to hear.
How do we do that?
Come on, let's take lunch.
That was part of it.
How? No, that's how he resisted, but that's not yet how he justified himself. You know.
No. Sure, there was all sorts of ways. There were minor lies said. Minor lies, major lies. But until we understand exactly how we behave in justification, until we understand that, the good word will be a good word, but, you know, what impact will it make exactly on the behavior that we use to justify ourselves? I think it's really important to understand our individual ways of justification daily on the job. That's why it's fascinating to read these interviews by Seth Circle. You know, multitudes of means, and you pointed out one right there. That's just one means among many, and each individual has his own sort of repertoire. You know, ways of acting on the stage, telling jokes, like John Fortune. You know, how do we do it? How do we get by the day?
So you think we ought to sizzle a little more here in the hot pan?
I don't know. I just wanted to offer a caution that I think it might be possible.
Maybe that suggests we ought not, go and read Romans 5 and 6, which says, you know, since then before we are justified by faith, we are now at peace with God through Jesus Christ our Lord. We've got access now to grace. Previously we didn't have access to grace apart from Christ. And the way we got access is by this curious thing called his death and resurrection. You know, I mean, that's a key link in the chain that made this thing work. But, and then he sketches it out and finally gets to the baptism section and says, okay, what I described in the first part of chapter 5 is, you know, what happened in 33 A.D., how did those of us sitting around here get linked into 33 A.D., to the Jesus of 33 A.D.? Well, baptism was the physical, tangible, creaturely, bodily link with that 33 A.D. death and resurrection, and now I'm going to ad-lib a little more about that, of how you get dyed
and buried and crucified, and you are brought to new life through this Christ linkage. Now, you know, that doesn't make it clear and say, oh, I saw a plate today, but that's at least the component part. But Tim's point, I think, might be more important for all of us individually and, corporately, husbands and wives, families, to think first before we say, hey, yeah, this sounds kind of tough, and if that sentence is right, we better quick run to find the medicine big enough to cure that. But to ask first, suppose that is what we experience, what other medicines do we regularly use anyhow? Do we regularly use already that are less than, the big Jesus Christ stuff to come out at least halfway clean or three-fourths clean?
Yeah, I want to, there's something else I want to get on the agenda tomorrow. I'm interested in what you're going to do with it. I've done a lot of work on what I would call a sociological analysis of these problems. That is to say, it's cast in terms that would enable it to be published in a secular social science journal. Mm-hmm.